Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat Dan Johnson Weinberger, Republican Chris Voronis, Steve Sevlich of the Chicago Tea Party Patriots, and Phil O'Connor, nuclear energy expert. Our program tonight, coming to you from our home base, the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, for the last several days, everyone around the world has been glued to the horrible stories and horrible pictures coming out of Japan in the wake of the tsunami, in the wake of the earthquake, and recently in the problems involving the Nuclear Energy Commission activities and power plants in Japan. So tonight, I want to at least begin our discussion about what we as Americans can do, should be doing. And Steve Sevlich is with us. And Steve, nice to have you with us. Steve is the coordinator of the Chicago Tea Party Patriot Movement. And obviously one of the things that the Tea Party folks are very concerned about is the budget, wasting federal dollars. And at a time when devastation takes place in Japan, the USS Ronald Reagan is heading towards the area right now to offer international humanitarian efforts. We have members of the Los Angeles County and Fairfax County search teams that are going there with 150 personnel. And so the United States will be expending quite a bit of money to help out a friend in need. As a member of the Tea Party, what should the role of Americans be when something like this happens? Because these are all off-budget expenditures.
Well, I think that we all see the level of devastation that's there in Japan, and you're right, they are an ally of ours, and it's a time of crisis. So we have a Navy that's there in the area and can respond, so I think that since we are in a position to do that, that's something we need to do. And I think the way you answer the question is important, because you said, what can Americans do? And if you look at the tsunami from a couple of years ago, the Americans, the people of America, were some of the most generous people in the world in terms of donating their time and efforts to go there, both financially in their own time to go there and help. And that's what I think that Americans' role is going to be again, that we are some of the most generous people in the world, and we're going to help there when there's people in need.
But again, if federal dollars have to be expended here, you think that's okay in a circumstance like this? Because, I mean, this seems to be happening more and more with the changing weather climates that we have in the world.
Well, I think that the likelihood of us having to deal with an 8.9 earthquake every week is probably less likely than all the troops that are just sitting in Europe protecting from an enemy that might not be there. So I have no problem with a good use if our military in Japan would be a good use.
Dan Johnson Weinberger joins us. He's our progressive this evening, our liberal. Nice to have you with us.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Bruce.
What's your reaction to that? As a young man watching this horrible video, what's your reaction?
I think it's so – I mean, it's just so sad to think whole cities are almost taken off the map. You know, you could imagine in Chicago they said it would be as if a 30-foot wave came off the shores of Lake Michigan and made it all the way to Pulaski. You know, it's just the devastation. It's just on a human level, it's so it's just horrible.
The early estimates are 10,000 people dead, but that basically is, quote, really only in one city. So we're expecting that the numbers will be considerably higher. Chris Voronis, your reaction?
It's utter devastation. You see that through the visuals, through the photos. we are in, the United States is a horrible financial predicament. But any money we send is well worth it. It's times like these. In my lifetime, certainly in the history books, I can't recall an earthquake on the scale of 9.0 on the Richter scale. So the giving, you know, as Steve said, Americans are very giving people. That will happen. Any federal support we can provide is well worth every dollar. And the important thing to note here, it's not just a time like this that reminds us that we're not Americans or Japanese. We're we're just people on a small planet. There's a humanitarian good, but there's also, you know, a responsibility our country has to find out what's happening on the ground. That is our experts, our military, our people over there, to get firsthand accounts of what's happening, particularly with their nuclear reactor.
And in this particular case, as someone who supports expansion of nuclear power, does this give you second thoughts?
What you had in Japan was just a horrific 1-2 punch of first a 9.0 earthquake, which shook their nuclear facility, but then the tsunami. So I think this was just a horrific anomaly that no one ever expected.
And their preparation was about as good as it possibly could be.
It was as good as it could be. It worked. They're pumping seawater in to cool the reactors right now. But to your point, absolutely, it gives people pause. And it right now, it's just a wait and see.
Steve, your reaction?
I think we have a lot of nuclear reactors here in Illinois where this show is being broadcast from, and they are built to withstand the largest earthquake that ever occurred here, which would be 8.1 on the Richter scale, the New Madrid fault line. So I think that what we need to do as a people is we need to put ourselves in the best position to react when something like this happens. And the way to do that is to make sure that you have a strong economy, that you have strong infrastructure, that you can deal with this sort of situation when it happens, that you're not at the mercy of nature.
Dan?
Well, it should give us pause. I mean, the risks of nuclear power are very small, of catastrophic events like this, but the downside of nuclear power is if something really rare happens that causes bad things to happen, the consequences can be very bad. And so it should give us pause. I think we have kind of been lulled into complacency since Chernobyl happened so long ago, and it's healthy that it gives us a new set of eyes to remember even very small risks of bad things happening with nuclear power can have really bad consequences.
But again, would you agree that at least as you're describing the bad things that can happen, I mean, they're I don't want to say once in a lifetime, but they're very unique and
right.
Very rare.
But, you know, they were very unique and rare for the deep water explosion that occurred as well. And very rare chances, that's not zero. And we need to just have it's healthy to remember that very small risks are, in fact, risks.
I think one of the other issues, obviously, there's the issues of life and death surrounding radiation. And by the way, the International Atomic Energy Agency reported just less than a half an hour ago that the most recent tests, literally within the hour in Japan, indicated that in the areas surrounding the three specific nuclear power plants, including the one that had an explosion last week, that all the levels have returned to normal. And again, the U.S. Atomic Energy also has reported that there have been no recorded impact at all on the western part of the United States. So the fallout on this, as of this moment in time, appears to be minimal, with minimal loss of lives. But again, it's not over yet. 1-800-723-8289 is our telephone number. I'd like to get your reaction as well. The role of the United States when tragedies occur around the world. How aggressive should we be? How generous can we be as individuals and as a country? Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for joining us. 1-800-723-8289 is the telephone number. And you were saying there's obviously quite a bit of activity on the tweets. You've been getting a lot of tweets on this subject, Dan?
I have.
Since you're the master of the tweets on this program?
Yeah, at DJW Info. I'd like to, and I sent out a tweet that I'd be on Beyond the Beltway tonight, as a matter
of
fact.
Well, we'll see if there's anybody listening.
Yeah, DJW Info, at.
Now, the question is this.
Yeah.
You say there's a lot of negative. I mean, there's a lot of World War II negativity.
I found
on this issue.
I was appalled and disgusted to find that there were a few people that were sending out tweets reminiscent of Pearl Harbor and taking some sick measure of satisfaction in this natural disaster. And I found some other tweets that drew my attention to it in the first place and said these people are, you know, atrocious. But he said, you know, if you look at the Japanese response to Hurricane Katrina and the global, philanthropy that occurred to help us out in our time of need, that the Japanese apparently were big givers to our post-Katrina rebuilding efforts.
Chris, you have a different perspective on that?
I embrace the Japanese helping out the citizens of New Orleans. No problem with that. I'm sure there are some people who are having some sick and bizarre fun at what's happening in Japan, but these people are outliers, and
But you were saying during the break that you think that culturally, we as a country, we should be very aggressive in wanting to know what really is going on there, because the Japanese culture may tend to be somewhat secretive about what really went on. I mean, a good example is that when they had the earthquake several years ago, they didn't want any outside help.
Yeah.
Now they are accepting outside help, not only from the United States, but also, believe it or not, I mean, they're accepting help from China and South Korea, who are no friends of Japan. And yet they're accepting help now because of the devastating nature of
it's just that
this
bad.
Incident.
There's a humanitarian dimension of this that's very, very important, and that, you know, a starving family isn't going to overlook a package that's got a U.S. flag on it. They're going to accept it. That's one. But two, we do have that responsibility to find out what's happening with nuclear radiation. We're not getting straight answers, and to have our people there helps the situation. I should also point out.
You should also mention, by the way, when the United States goes there, I mean, the United States, they are basically following the direction of the Japanese government as to where their sources and their resources are supposed to be put. Now, it's not like, again, we're not putting soldiers in any combative way, but again, we're following a direction of, in this case, the host country, which is what I think it should be.
I think that's right. It's kind of nice, I think, that our military is being used to save lives. You know, it's nice that we were able to ferry helicopters back and forth and drop off water. And
it happened in Katrina.
Right. I mean, that's what all that money we spend on the military, it's nice to use it to save people's lives.
Well, I think that's what Steve's point was taken, is that we have this military force. We have to use it for whatever force needs to be used at that particular time.
And we have a Navy that covers the entire world. We're the only country that could respond as quickly as we do because of the great military that we have.
Is the big issue here, again, obviously, if we now believe, based on the most recent reports, that a nuclear devastation is not likely to come in the wake of what we have been watching for the last week, Japan is a country that is an economic basket case. I mean, how do they ever recover from this devastation? Anybody want to tackle that one?
I don't think you can call one of the strongest economies in the world an economic basket case. I mean, they had some of their banks that made a lot of bad loans, and that doesn't sound too far off the reservation from where we are, but it's clearly one of the strongest economies in the world, and I wouldn't call it anything like a basket case. I actually spent some time working with the Japanese for high-speed rail as they're looking to sell some of their bullet train technology over here. And one of the things that I learned from talking to them, after what Chris had mentioned, that maybe their culture isn't as philanthropic, interestingly, the Japanese tax code doesn't give the same write-offs for charitable contributions that the American tax code does. So one of the reasons we've got such big foundations is that we essentially subsidize them, right? If you get a tax write-off. They don't have that in Japan. So their tax code doesn't encourage, it's basically a government subsidy what we have over here, right? All charities are really government subsidized because it's a write-off to the donor, and they don't have that in Japan. So that could be one of the reasons why they don't have the same philanthropic institutions, because their government doesn't subsidize it the way that ours does.
Steve, you were going to make a point?
Yeah, about Japan's economy. They just went through a lost decade where they went and bailed out all their zombie banks, and their economy never recovered. So I don't think we want to be following their example on that. And as opposed to getting rid of exemptions for charitable deductions, that's one of the things that's great about America, that people are giving out of their own money to support charities. And if we end the incentive for charitable deductions, we're going to see a lot of charities close up shop.
I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but, you know, it's a subsidy.
Let's go to Carla listening to us on what station are you listening to us on tonight?
KGSR in Austin, Texas.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
I was calling regarding your conversation a little bit earlier where you were talking about the military cover-up regarding the radiation exposure?
I don't know if we were calling it a cover-up, but you wanted to make a point?
Well, I want to say it's a cover-up.
Okay, all right.
Because I'm a 63-year-old Air Force brat. The first time my father was exposed to hydrogen was when he scrubbed down an airplane that was brought to Kwajalein, and they had a lot of names for that project. It was called Project Ivy, Project Big Mike, whatever. And he was in a raincoat, and he used a mop bucket. And
Carla, how does this relate to what we're talking about on the radio right now and what's happening in Japan and what role the United States should have in helping the Japanese?
Well, I
Is
think
there
that,
a relation?
Well, the jet stream, the nuclear stuff going into the jet stream and coming over, you know, through the United States all the way up to Chicago. You know, and I'm concerned about that.
Well, again, in the situation that we have, at least the International Atomic Energy Regulatory Agency and those that are monitoring more specifically in the United States have said thus far that there's no issue. So you're questioning their the veracity of those reports at this moment?
Well, I'm questioning the truth of it.
Okay, well, I guess everybody can question everything else. Do you have any reason to doubt them? I guess.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I know you do, but I'm asking if there's anybody around the table that has that concern. Steve, you're the Tea Party guy. You must.
You're supposed to, right?
I'm just a Tea Party person. I'm not the resident conspiracy nut.
Okay, listen, thanks very much for your call. We appreciate it. 1-800-723-8289. Again, in looking at other aspects of this, in just a few moments, by the way, we're going to be hearing from Phil O'Connor, who has some expertise in the nuclear regulatory area, and we'll talk more with him about that. Insofar as this, the coverage of this, has the coverage been accurate, or do you think it's been a little too hysterical, at least in the early hours? You know, alerting and probably scaring the pants off most people living in the western part of the United States.
They say one of the first casualties in a crisis situation is the truth. We just don't know what's happening over there right now. News accounts are getting out. I mean, we're getting an idea of the extent.
But Hawaii is still there. Right. I mean, the initial reports I was watching that, you know, Hawaii was going to be washed away. You know?
Exactly right. In the wake of the news, people thought Hawaii was done for. It's not the case, obviously.
Well, is it better to alert the people about the potential? Again, we don't quite know.
Absolutely.
What a tsunami would be, or do we err on the wrong side there?
I think you should say, look, there's a 9.0 quake. There's a tsunami that devastated northeast Japan. Yeah. It could devastate Hawaii. It could devastate the west coast. I mean, you know, it hits Japan and then it comes over the other way.
The problem is, though, is when rumor and conjecture makes its way into legitimate news coverage and that's sent around the world.
Well, hopefully
that's the problem.
I mean, message is evacuate, and I think hopefully a lot of people did.
Well, everybody was doing that. Let's go to Steve listening to us on KLBJ. I don't know what station that last caller was listening on, but you're listening on KLBJ, right?
Yes.
Okay, good, because that's our affiliate in Austin. Go ahead.
Yeah. I think that the U.S. responsibility should be to respond and should be to help in any way that we can and hopefully with good direction from the Japanese government. I think the budget balancing aspect of that might be to say, hey, you know, all those international foreign aid appropriations that we carve out every year, let's take some of that money back after we figure out how much we've spent in an effort to be a little more conservative about the money that we are spending. And then the second thing, and I don't know where you guys are at on the technology side of this thing, but I've had a lot of involvement in alternative energy and atomic energy, just peripherally as a consultant, and there is a whole family of new technology for atomic energy, mini reactors the size of a waste paper basket that cannot meltdown, cannot go critical. And I think situations like this with the Japanese infrastructure are the kinds of things that should militate as we move forward to look at these mini reactor type technologies, which are far, far safer than what we've been building over the last 30 or 40 years.
Okay, well, I think that you've certainly brought up a subject that will be part of the discussion as I think the United States and people around the world are going to be looking at these alternatives. And we're going to continue with on that theme when we continue from Chicago, 1-800-723-8289. When we come back, more talk about nuclear power. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. Our progressive tonight is Dan Johnson Weinberger. He is a lawyer, a graduate of the University of Chicago, where his professor was Barack Obama. And he is now a progressive lobbyist for a variety of entities. Also joining us this evening is Chris Voronis, his college friend from the University of Illinois when they were undergraduates. And also a columnist in the Daily Paper there, right? The Daily Illini?
Yeah.
You were competing left-right columnist, right?
Every week.
And you are now a conservative public relations expert. Or your public relations executive who happens to be conservative.
Exactly.
And you consider yourself conservative or Republican? Which do you put first?
Conservative first.
You're a conservative first?
Yes. Okay.
Also joining us this evening is Steve Sevelick. He is the coordinator of the Chicago Tea Party Patriots, and he's also involved in a healthcare field as a consultant and became involved in the Tea Party movement after he was moved by the rant of Rick Santelli. That got him out of his chair and into the streets, and now is in the leadership of the Tea Party movement in the state of Illinois. And recently, his chapter at the recent CPAC convention of the Chicago Tea Party Patriots received the Ronald Reagan Award. So congratulations. What is the Ronald Reagan Award?
The Ronald Reagan Award is CPAC's highest honor, and they give it for grassroots activism. It's for not the generals in the conservative movement, but the people that are out there toiling in the field. So we're very honored and humbled to win it.
Very good. And speaking of awards, if I can ask our director to pull back a little bit to see this award, which the Museum of Broadcast Communications received this past week. And let me read the inscription. On behalf of students of the civil rights movement of all ages, King College Prep thanks the Museum of Broadcast Communications for sharing its footage with the world, February 2011. And I was honored to share the stage with Dr. Bernice King, the youngest daughter of the late Martin Luther King Jr., at the Kennedy King College Prep in Chicago, which is celebrating its 40th anniversary as a school, one of the first schools in the nation named after Dr. King. And it was because of a program we have called DocuFest, which allows us to share our digitized collection of over 470 programs about the American Civil Rights Movement with people all over the world. So the historic moments of that were shared on television, it was an American, obviously, movement that was carried out in America's living rooms. And again, we have that content. It's available to those that go to our website, museum.tv, and it was nice to receive that honor with Dr. King's daughter standing by to take a look at it.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
one of our, and I should also mention that Oprah Winfrey provided the funding to digitize all that content, so we thank the Oprah Winfrey Foundation for having that vision many, many years ago.
All right.
Right now we're going to be joined by an old friend of this program, Philip O'Connor. Phil, nice to have you with us. Philip O'Connor is the chairman of the Illinois, or was once upon a time, the chairman of the Illinois Commerce Commission, and I understand he is not here, so he is still an old friend, but he's not here yet. But we have lots of callers, so let's go to them. Let's go to Tom, listening to us in South Carolina on Sirius Satellite XM. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just going to repeat something I'd heard earlier on NPR, a commentator concerning Japan, that depends on how bad this is as far as the money, the rebuilding and what have you, that it could put them in a position of pulling out to buy any more bonds. And I think they're the second or third largest bondholder. But not only that, the rate on the international market to raise money for the rebuilding. Now, it may not be $10 or $20 billion, we've almost got to the point where that's not big money anymore with our bonds to rebuild. But if this thing starts running into the hundreds of billions of dollars rebuild for Japan, they're going to become a real competitor on the international market, which is going to impact our ability to sell bonds as well as therefore pushing up our interest rates to try to sell our bonds.
All right, let's let Chris tackle that one first. Again, the impact of Japan's rebuilding on our economy.
It's a 9.0 earthquake. I mean, I don't know how else you can look at this. It's a natural disaster on the highest scale. We haven't seen like anything like this in generations. And foreign aid, foreign support, humanitarian support is worth its weight in gold. You know, one important thing about how this speaks to our national interests is the positive outcome that happened in Egypt was largely attributed to our close relationship with Egypt. That included foreign aid. Our military, our generals knew their generals very well. They invited their generals over for dinner. They knew their families. So the point here is foreign aid, foreign support done the right way is worth its weight in gold.
I want to go back to a question I asked at the beginning of the program. Steve, the perception of the Tea Party movement, and we should mention the Tea Party movement, as you said, is very disorganized. It's a divergent group of people from all over the United States, so it's hard to put any particular label on them, even though many in the liberal press have done that. And we're going to talk about that in the next hour with some of the unfortunate and stupid statements made by some former NPR executives. But generally speaking, as a perception, you don't necessarily think of Tea Party people thinking beyond our shores, thinking with foreign policy related issues. So put our mind at ease or share with the audience whether you think that is a popular perception.
I think that is perception, and I think it's accurate only because the Tea Party movement is focused on domestic policy. We're focused on fiscal responsibility and getting our government back to within what's prescribed under the Constitution. So as individuals in the Tea Party movement, everyone probably has opinions on foreign policy, but since we're not in that realm, we try to keep that out of
but
it.
But I guess the question I would have is how can you be in the realm of the real world and draw a line at the boundaries of the United States and say, okay, we're going to be involved in this, and we're going to focus our attention on this, and we're going to turn our backs on everything else that happens beyond that, because so much of what we have seen on television happens beyond our shores, and they are things that when we look at them, we should be cheering them, like what happened in Egypt or what's happening in Libya, and yet we have the reality of the devastation about what's happening with the tsunami halfway around the world in Japan. So how do you become hard-nosed in one area? Aren't you not swimming in waters of reality?
Well, we're only involved in one area, so we can't be all things to all people, and that's the thing that people are motivated by. The movement's very diverse, so you have people that are strong supporters of our military and want to continue intervention around the world, and it ranges down to people that oppose both wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and want the military out of every single country. So those are people that are in the Tea Party, but we get along because we're focused on economic issues and what's going to save the country in the future.
Well, and thank God we're a republic. We're a representative government where we have people, we elect people who make decisions for us. The Tea Party movement is healthy. The Tea Party movement is making fiscal responsibility an issue that heretofore was not. So that's all good. It's prompting debate, it's decisions, new set of priorities. At the end of the day, we still have people who make decisions for us and don't make an issue like humanitarian aid to Japan mutually exclusive with fiscal responsibility.
But we could
do both.
But do elected officials have a in your view, do elected officials have a responsibility to explain to the public, and I don't mean just to the Tea Party movement. I mean even to their constituents, in explaining things that their constituents may not want to hear. What is the role of educating the public about the real world, which basically it says, as we said at the beginning of the program, when something horrible happens around the world, to a nation that has been friendly to you for 50 years, that as a good neighbor and as a humanitarian, you have some responsibility to help them, and that costs money, and you may have to borrow that money from some other source, including a future generation. Dan?
Especially because in most polls, when people say, well, I want to cut government spending, and then you ask, well, what do you really want to cut? Do you really want to cut education? No, I don't. Do you really want to cut, you know, transportation infrastructure? No, I don't. Do you want to cut health care? No, I don't. How about foreign aid? Sure, I'm open to that. That's the one that has the least amount of support in sort of the general polls about when you get beyond, gee, I don't like government spending. You say, well, what about health care? Oh, I like health care spending. Education. I like education spending. We have an education challenge ahead of us to say that the relatively paltry amount of money that we spend on foreign aid.
And it's relatively small.
Yes, especially compared to all of our other economic peers that spend a relatively higher percentage of their GDP than we do. We have not earned the support of the American people on foreign aid money. That is the least amount of support about all categories of spending of anything. And that is probably the reason why we don't spend that much relative to our GDP on foreign aid.
Would you agree with that, Steve?
Yeah, I'd agree. It's just not that big a percentage of the budget. And in the end, it doesn't really make a dent, even if we got rid of all of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And yet we have to convince. I think part of the reason is this sort of notion of government spending is bad, which is unfortunately out there way too much, drags down a lot of the excellent investments like foreign aid that can help make the world a far better sustainable place.
Now, you may recall just about 15 minutes ago, I promised you that Phil O'Connor was going to be on this program. And so I'm going to make that promise one more time.
You're on the record.
When we come back, our good friend Phil O'Connor better be there back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, and now Phil O'Connor, are you there?
Here I am, Bruce. I was sitting home minding my own business, listening to the show, and heard I was supposed to be on, so I called
very
the
good
producer.
Well, it's nice to have you with us. I should mention to the audience, you are the former chair of the Illinois Commerce Commission. You've been involved in nuclear power-related issues for much of the last 20-plus years. And a question I would like to ask you, because one of the big questions that I think will be discussed and debated for the next several weeks or months is the signals from Japan, the scare about what happened in Japan or is happening in Japan, is that in any way going to retard ongoing discussions about expanding nuclear power in the United States, and should it in any way?
Well, I think it'll have a big influence on the discussion. And I think it should influence it because, maybe not for the obvious reasons, but this will raise some issues about how we think about emergency procedures and decision-making. And one of the things that may have happened here is that while the everything responded just the way it was supposed to after the earthquake, the tsunami took out the backup systems, or the backup electricity, really. There may have been some delays in decision-making trying to restore that electricity rather than immediately putting in the seawater, which I can understand why they delayed, because seawater does end up destroying the reactor.
So if you were advising the Atomic Energy Commission or members of Congress tomorrow, if they were to ask you, what sort of testing or procedural assessments do you think should be going on in the United States right now?
Well, these things are like airplane crashes. The first reaction is usually wrong. So I think the first thing I'd urge them to do is not put out a bunch of press releases and try to get on television talking about it. This is going to take a lot of analysis. We don't yet know how it's going to turn out, of course, although there are indications at the moment that the Japanese are getting this under control. And I've got to say, there's some very courageous people. You you can bet working 24 hours a day there inside those buildings and around them, you know, trying to get this under control. So I would say we need to wait. The first analyses are probably going to have a lot of error in them.
One of the things that are, well, we had one guest who's here, Chris Veronis, who is our Republican guest this evening. He offered the thought earlier in the broadcast that we as Americans and representing the government, we have to make sure that the Japanese government is being completely candid in sharing the news and the information of their investigation, because in many cases, if there's an internal investigation going on that shows some deficiencies in planning, there is certainly a great deal of pride in the Japanese culture, as certainly as it relates to technology, that they might not want to acknowledge and share with the world. It's not quite meant to be a conspiratorial-focused question, but do you see that as a concern? And how do we, as Ronald Reagan suggests, how do we trust and verify what our good friends the Japanese tell us about what happened and how they planned for this event?
I think there are several things. First is I think some lessons were learned during the Three Mile Island incident in our own country about openness in these matters. And it appears to me from the reporting on this and the way the Japanese government, and for that matter Tokyo Electric, are responding, is a lot of those lessons were learned. It's important not to say things before you know them, but on the other hand, to report what you know in a timely way. It seems to me they've been doing that. Second thing is, quite unlike the Chernobyl situation where the Soviets had a very closed system, there really is a fraternity of nuclear regulatory people in the Western world, which I include Japan. So the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in this country, General Electric, which supplied one of the units that's having a problem, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which is incidentally is headed by a Japanese national. I think we're going to see a lot of openness in this and a pretty open slate.
And in the last segment, we talked about the role of the media in telling this story. And my question to you is, what grade would you give them thus far? Have they properly alerted the public, or have they inadvertently scared the public to death?
No, I think the reporting's been pretty lucid and fair-minded at this point. Now, I have to say, I don't know what the reporting in Japan has been, but I have been following our own and the BBC and so forth, and I think it's been pretty straightforward and a fairly reasonable assessment of the situation.
And again, to let you weigh in on the subject we asked at the beginning of the program, when people are watching these devastating stories, they think obviously that the United States and people of the world have an opportunity to reach out and help those in trouble, but they worry in tough economic times for the country how much we as a nation can afford to help those who are worthy of our support. Your thoughts on that?
Oh, I mean, we have to help Japan. We're very close to them. They're very important to us. I just don't see any reason not to. I will tell you this about this situation. It could have been a lot worse on the nuclear side. That station has six units. Two of them are having problems. Three of them were actually out of operation for maintenance. So if all six had been operating, which would have been a little unlikely, this could have been much more difficult.
Right. Well, that's good news to end the report with. Phil O'Connor, thanks very much for joining
us. Thank you,
Bruce. For your insight. And when we continue on our next hour, we're going to be talking about a variety of things, including what's happening in the state of Wisconsin, the budget battle, and the loose lips at NPR.
Oh.
Back shortly. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by Democrat Dan Johnson-Weinberger, Republican Chris Voronis, and Steve Sevlich of the Chicago Tea Party Patriots. Our program tonight, comedy from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it is www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, in this hour, we're going to talk about a variety of subjects, and I would like to begin by talking about all of the politics that is emerging out of the state to our north, Wisconsin, where we do this broadcast from Chicago every Sunday night. And my question to you, I want to talk with you, start with you, Steve. Steve Sevlich of the Tea Party Movement. How big a deal is what is happening and what has happened in Wisconsin? And is that a firestorm that's going to spread elsewhere? And will it ultimately result in similar movements by similar governors around the United States?
Absolutely. It's huge. And I think even Dan would agree how important what's going on in Wisconsin is to the rest of the country. It's just the first state across the country that's going to take a look at what to do about the public sector unions. Ohio's already passed legislation. So what happens in Wisconsin is going to not stay in Wisconsin. It's going to spread around the country. And I think you see both sides galvanized. And I say, let's debate it. Let's talk
about what the issue. Liberal tonight is Dan Johnson-Weinberger. Those are fighting words. Do you agree with that assessment? And are you glad that this is a fight that's going to be carried on?
I agree with the assessment that it is helping to define the terms of the debate. And I think it's a very big deal. I think the biggest labor rally in years happened in Madison, dwarfing any Tea Party rallies that have occurred in Wisconsin. I think
a lot of people imported from Illinois, though.
Absolutely. The whole Midwest. I mean, it's a movement. And I think it's a movement to build up the middle class and to stand against this assault on the middle class, which just happened in Madison. I think the terms of the debate are growing starker, and I think a lot of people are now seeing what's behind a lot of the Republican resurgence are these billionaires that just want to drive wages down. And I think it's going to be a great debate for the next 2 years.
Chris Voronis is our Republican tonight. Chris?
We'll see if they turn out at the polls, Dan, and where it really matters instead of a rally. I mean, frankly, Governor Walker made a very courageous move and took a sacred cow head on. The Wisconsin budget deficit is appalling, just like any other state's budget deficit. And the crazy thing that you have here, this legalized racket that public sector unions have, is traditionally employees who've got grievances with their employers, they pick a union. The union will represent them at the table. Here you have public sector employee unions who choose their politicians and negotiate favorable labor contracts with them. In effect, what you wind up with is double taxation. We're paying for services, and we're paying for these outlandish labor contracts that are contributing to state budget deficits across the country.
Would you agree that as the labor movement flexes its muscle and business elements are going to flex their muscle and the Tea Party is going to continue to flex their muscles, what about the people out there who don't neatly fall into any one of those groups,
yep,
but who represent the majority of voters, I think? And where do you think they're coming down, Steve? Where do you think the public opinion shifting as to how this story is being played?
Well, I think if you define the issue as a question of collective bargaining rights, then it's probably going to be something that's going to favor the Democrats. But we know that that's not the case, that there are no collective bargaining rights in the Constitution, that it's something that even in the People's Republic of Madison they haven't had since 1959. That's when it started. So I think when you look at the questions of should a person in a union be forced to be in the union, should they have an option to pay their dues? And if you look at what happened in Indiana, state employees were given that option, and 95% have chosen that they don't want their union dues to go to politicians.
Dan.
So Of course it's a question of collective bargaining rights. That's what the bill is about. And the fact that the right was relatively recent and not in the 1787 draft of the Constitution is irrelevant. I think what's happening to your question, the people in the middle that are not members of a union, because the labor movement, in the face of an unrelenting corporate assault from most of our governments that have been shrinking the protections of people that want to join a union, the middle class is shrinking in this country. That's what's happening. And labor unions are one of the main reasons why wages go up. So as people start to feel, you know what? I'm not making as much money as I was 2-4 years ago. As my parents said, life was easier. The Tea Party made a case, well, it's the government's fault. It's government spending, right? That was sort of the main message of the Tea Party. Government spending, that's going to make life better. Now, I think people are seeing what is part of the Republican governing coalition in states where they run things is drive down wages by destroying the labor movement.
But insofar as, again, we're talking about how we reach the sectors of the voting population that don't fit into any of the defined boxes we have here tonight, the independents and or the casually interested. My question to you as a public relations executive is the key to that separating, being able to separate in the court of public opinion how one feels about a union and how one feels about a public sector union. Because in many cases, they may have entirely different opinions between how they feel about those unions.
They may like the automotive, because
they may be members of the union, but they don't like the idea of public employees.
The distinction is very important. And for a long time, it's been the dirty little secret that's just being aired over the last 2 years. I mean, frankly, you look across the public sector, when there's a recession, tough choices are made. And you've had public sector unions who have been an insulated, protected class because they've been able to negotiate labor contracts, favorable wages, favorable benefits with the politicians who they've elected into office, by the way. I mean, a legalized racket. You're seeing intense public disapproval of that. Once people understood, you look across the private sector, you don't have defined benefit or defined benefit. Pensions are shrinking as a share of how people make what their retirement benefits are. Public sector, they're thriving. Why is that? People look at their retirement benefits and are like, this is a time of shared sacrifice. Why aren't public sector unions a part of that?
Steve.
Dan mentioned that the middle class is shrinking, and it is, and it's because people aren't working. And there's not going to be a lot of sympathy for people that don't work right now for to sustain a salary of $160,000 a year for a bus driver.
Most public sector unions make between $40,000 and $60,000. Most public sector union members.
Full compensation?
Yeah.
With insurance and
absolutely,
pension?
Absolutely. Most private sector people
I think
work in industries that don't have unions.
What's your source with that? Because the other guests are shaking no.
I mean, we'll go do our Twitter search and see what it is.
Well, I wouldn't look at Twitter.
Hey, take police and fire out. But most teachers don't make that much money.
I'm talking about total compensation. I'm talking about wages, health care, retirement, combined total compensation. I mean, that's in the six figures.
Folks, we've got to pause. The question is, was the prairie fire that started in Wisconsin, politically speaking, is that going to grow? And if so, will it dominate the 2012 presidential season? Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to John listening to us in the state of Wisconsin on our flagship station, WLS. Go ahead, John. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. I just wanted to say, as a former Illinois resident of Cook County, I just wanted to thank Governor Walker for saving 1,600 great middle-class jobs. And he did it not by a package that would increase the debt, but he did it by balancing a budget. God bless that man. Once people see it take effect, that wildfire that you're talking about, Bruce, will spread. And all it takes is a look at what's going on or what has happened in Michigan, what is happening in Illinois, and what we just did up here. Take care, guys. Have a good evening.
Okay, thanks very much.
So here's the part I don't know.
One guy against you, but go ahead.
Well, yeah, I'm going to count
against
you.
And you're tweeting
me.
For all your union friends to call in?
I'm trying to find out what the average compensation of a teacher is, and I'm finding that it is in the 40 to 60 range. To Chris's point on salary, but not on benefits, I can't find what the total benefit package is just yet. However, if we're really at a time of shared sacrifice, if that's really true, why is it that the Republicans that are so insistent that we bust every union and make it difficult to get a middle-class job, because that's what it was about, ending collective bargaining rights.
How is it about busting the union?
That's what it is. You're busting the union by ending collective bargaining rights. Here's the question.
And do you
realize why is it that in the shared sacrifice never seems to apply to those with high incomes? And raising taxes on our millionaires is never on the table. It brings the lie to the idea that this is a time of shared sacrifice. And what it is about is shifting wealth upward.
Chris,
a couple of things, Dan. You should ask your own president who championed the tax cut package that just passed 4 months ago.
Yeah, he reluctantly accepted the deal with the Republicans. Who insisted on it? True?
He reprimanded his own party on the tax cuts.
He reluctantly accepted the deal, which the Republicans insisted upon.
Steve.
This is about jobs, and if you look at the union position is that people should be hired and fired based on seniority. The position of the taxpayers is that people should be hired and fired based on the quality of their work. In Milwaukee, we had the case of Megan Sampson, who was the teacher of the year, and she ended up getting fired because she didn't have seniority. So should we be firing the best teachers, or should we be firing the people that had the most seniority?
You can change work rules, but that doesn't mean that you abolish collective bargaining. They're different questions.
Not only did Barack Obama champion tax cuts 4 months ago, but some of the pillars of the Democratic Party and the progressive movement, Samuel Gompers, George Meany, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, all were horrified about public sector unions because they warned us because they understood how insidious this could become. A legalized racket. And I want to speak to Dan's point, too, about collective bargaining.
I want Dan to respond to what you've just said, because quoting Roosevelt has been very fashionable by Republicans in the last month and a half. What do you say to one of the great, you know, liberal, progressive political leaders of all time who warned the nation about the perils
of... And he passed collective bargaining rights, by the way. He passed it, the Wagner Act.
He wasn't anti-union, but yet... He warned that some unions can go too far.
Well, sadly, it's sad that our public sector unions are the only growing part of the organized workforce. And that's one of the reasons why our private sector wages have gone down so much. Keep in mind, private sector wages have been plummeting over the last 30 years. And public sector unions have been able to, through the political process, stop the assault on organizing in the private sector and carve out some space in the public sector. I understand the point that President Roosevelt made that Republicans are fond of quoting, that it would be ideal to have more private sector unions. Unfortunately, there is an anti-union regime that we're living under where it's almost impossible to organize a private sector union in this country.
Go ahead.
Well, it's called globalism in 2011.
No, it's called labor law.
We live in a global
community.
No, it's
just called labor law. And it's labor laws.
The reality is Dan talks about collective bargaining rights being stripped out. Frankly, the important thing to keep in mind here is that teachers get wage and benefit increases under the measure that was passed. One. Two, yes, collective bargaining rights are stripped. But by the way, that is the mechanism by which costs, wage increases, and benefit increases are sunk into the operating budgets of state government. So you have to remove the mechanism that year over year guarantees public sector employees the Cadillac benefits that they've enjoyed to this date.
We're going to go to Joe listening inside the Beltway online from Washington, D.C. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I'm listening to the back and forth. And, you know, we've got a problem in this country of, you know, every state is faced with unemployment rates, at least 8 to 9% unemployment rates. And something's got to be done. I mean, you know, government spending, you know, governments, state governments have to be responsible and pass budgets that are, you know, within their means. I guess I'm looking at this bill that they passed in Wisconsin. And my question is, you know, what's so bad about it? You know, I'm reading this story in Bloomberg, and it says that Governor Walker's bill would limit negotiations to wages, not benefits or working conditions. Raises wouldn't exceed inflation without voters' consent, and workers' contributions toward their health care and pensions would rise. Police and firefighters would be exempt. My question to Dan is, what's so bad about that?
Well, here's what's bad about it. If you believe in a middle class in this country, the way you build it is with collective bargaining rights. And you can look what's happening in the private sector. Without those collective, without unions, wages don't rise. So if you want a middle class, you need a strong labor movement. There isn't any other way to do it, especially at a time when we just refuse to tax wealthy people in order to fund the construction of a middle class by the type of health care benefits that we all deserve.
I can't think of
that's what's wrong with it.
Perversity that's been uttered on this show than Dan linking the growth of the middle class with the growth of the union.
That's the economic truth, Chris. That's how it is.
Look, since 1955, when the AFL and the CIO merged, unions have been on the decline while the economy has been increasing throughout those years. How do you explain that?
Since
people are leaving unions. People don't want to be part of unions. And what's happening right now?
That's not true that people don't want to be part of the union.
What's happening right now with the public sector unions is a legalized racket in which the lid's being blown off. And we're coming to terms with you can't have your cake and eat it too.
By the way, let me just interject. According to U.S. Labor Department statistics, as communicated to me by our producer, Jason Scherer, this evening, private sector, the average private sector employee is paid $28 an hour. The average public employee is paid $40 an hour. Average.
So who does that jibe with your sense that most teachers make $80,000 a year? Because the teachers I know don't make anything close to that in the public sector.
Well, in Milwaukee, they make over $100,000 a year in terms of salary and compensation. The question is this, do you want your state governments to use their money to pay for health care and social services, or do you want their state governments to spend all their money on teachers' pensions and debt service? Because that's where we are. So I think that even most people on the progressive side would rather have the state spend money on actual people in health care and social services rather than Cadillac pensions.
But again, however, if a pension plan is in place and someone is paid into that pension plan year in, year out, even though it may have been a bad deal, a deal is a deal. A person that's paid into that pension should not have that pension pulled out from them.
I'd agree.
Again, you might want to say, starting right now, looking to the future, we're going to change the rules. But I don't think you change the rules on anybody looking backwards, and I feel the same way about Social Security.
I'd agree. But in Wisconsin, they don't pay into their pension. The state of Wisconsin was paying the government portion and the employee portion.
The part that you're missing is the part where the wealthy, since we're living in the era of the biggest economic inequality since the 20s, is that they start paying their fair share to the government so that the rest of us can enjoy a middle-class lifestyle. I don't think that the private sector has lost all defined benefit pensions, which is another way of saying people are getting poorer, which is what's happening without your defined benefit pension. That's not a model for the rest of the country.
Last time I checked, 401ks outperformed any kind of government pension program.
Eric, listening on KLBJ in Austin, Texas. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. So to begin with, I was raised a Reagan conservative who, by the way, in case nobody's seen it, there's a speech in which he equates collective bargaining with freedom. But that's neither here nor there. You know, if you want a connection between unions' collective bargaining abilities and the rise or fall of the middle class, I think a great example is to look at the private sector versus the public sector. The private sector, the unions have been gutted, and our wages have stagnated over the past 30 years. Meanwhile, the public sector, they've remained unionized, and their wages have increased. Now, my general question to you is this. Why should the rank-and-file worker of America support a system that basically only benefits the top 10%
right,
and screws everybody else?
Right. And that's the...
Chris.
Well, their wages have increased because they've elected politicians who have told them, I'm on your side. I mean, it's a racket. It's a perfectly legalized racket.
Look, you can keep repeating that nice little phrase, but the reality is the people elect the politicians.
Cost?
Guess what? The people ultimately elect the politicians, right? Not the unions, not even corporate money. The people ultimately elect the politicians.
The unions have no muscle then
sure,
in elections.
They get to make their voice heard.
They're not a powerful constituency,
the Democratic
Party. Let's
not pretend that the unions elect anybody. The people do, just like corporate money doesn't elect anybody, right? On my side. The people ultimately do.
Both sides spend money to elect officials who are going to vote their way.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right.
And while there may be a lot of people out there that want to support unions and public sector unions even, there's not a lot of support for government monopoly on the workforce. If I want to go into a school and be a teacher, I can't do it without joining the union and having my dues go to the union. Why not?
Because that's how collective bargaining works, so that you have middle-class wages that you can sustain a family on. That's why they're trying to get rid of collective bargaining, so you drive down wages.
Back shortly from Chicago, 1-800-723-8289. Your calls could be next. Bustamante back in Chicago tonight. Our liberal is Dan Johnson Weinberger. He is a lobbyist with his own progressive consulting firm. Chris Baronis also joins us. He is a public relations executive for one of the country's leading public relations firm. And Steve Sevelick also joins us. He is the coordinator of the Chicago Tea Party Patriots. And recently at the CPAC convention, his group received the Ronald Reagan Award, the highest award that they give. So congratulations to him. And again, phone lines open, 1-800-723-8289. We're going to go back to calls in just a moment, and we have lots of callers that are coming in. Let me mention, by the way, we have a conflicting economic issue that came in from someone quoting the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., comparing teachers' salaries. With a bachelor's degree, a public employee gets $62,000 a year. A private sector employee would get $81,000 a year. So they wanted us to put that on the air, so we have done that. We're going to go back to calls, but I cannot miss the opportunity to delve into 2012 politics. Chris Veronis, since Dan Johnson Weinberger is speaking for a lot on the left that would love to take this Wisconsin fight and turn it national, because they think by doing it,
it's going to help.
It's going to help them.
Absolutely.
And I don't know where do you agree with the same thing? Do you agree that a good public?
I'd say let the wildfire grow.
Okay, now
let it happen.
All right, now. So we have agreement from both of our sides, and our Tea Party person. You like open debate, right?
I love this debate. I think by the time the election rolls around, we'll be in good shape.
So let the Tea Party flow. Let this debate, you know, with its fire and brimstone rhetoric, let it flow.
One coda, okay. One addition. And you're going to like it.
Liberal wants to change the rule. Go ahead.
You're going to like it. The next election that matters in this debate will be the recall elections of those Wisconsin senators. They're petitioning now. I predict some of them are going to happen in 2011. I don't know the laws on the recall for the governor. They can't start till January 1, 2012. But if that happens before November 2012, those elections are going to help shape the debate.
You mean all the flea party Democrats we're going to get rid of in Wisconsin?
You mean the Abraham Lincoln Democrats who did the only thing they could to stand up the fabulous 14 in the face of an unrelenting assault on the middle class? Like the Fab 14 Wisconsin senators came to Illinois.
I like the flea party Democrats.
Yeah,
pretty
right.
Good. Here's my question. Could this ignite a Scott Walker for president campaign? Chris Veronis, could he be the Republican nominee for president of the United States?
No.
Why not?
Too early. Young guy. We'll see how he finishes out the 3.5 years that's left in his term. But certainly, he's proven himself as one governor in this nation who makes bold calls and puts
Christie does too.
Chris Christie too, but not on the scale of Scott Walker. Chris Christie did everything by executive order. Scott Walker actually put his own political lifeline on his own neck.
Steve, what about it?
Chopping block.
Is he your guy? Could he be your guy?
We stand with Scott Walker. We went to Madison for the rallies ourselves. I'd agree it's probably too early because with the realities of presidential politics, you're going to have a campaign going through the summer, and he's got his hands full. He's got work to do, which is where he should be.
Would you like him to be the – would you like him to jump
in? Oh, I would love to see another half-term governor represent the Republicans on the national ticket. Reminds me of Sarah Palin, a half-term governor, right? That's all he would have, two years under his four-year belt. I think it would be a disaster for the Republicans.
Do you think that a message that questions a two-term governor, do you measure the power of that message against the power of the person who many believe had the gonads to take on the unions in this battle? And if indeed this becomes a political prairie fire that takes off, just as Barack Obama took off,
right,
how do you stop a prairie fire once it gets started? You don't.
You can't stop a prairie fire. That baby burns. You're right. I think there are two competing prairie fires out there. In the Tea Party, and Walker started one, and now the Democrats and Labor and the progressives have started another one. Been more people for ours. That's just a fact. So which fire is going to burn more hotly?
What are you counting now?
People. There were, 150,000 people in Madison.
You mean you were able to attract more liberals in Madison, Wisconsin? That's quite an achievement.
There were – we established many weeks ago on this program.
Yeah.
There were more people in the state of Wisconsin who stayed home, who didn't go to either rally, who never showed up at the Capitol. They are the majority of the people.
Well, how do you
not the people that show up at the
well,
rally?
How do you measure the intensity of a prairie fire?
Well, you
right, you got to come up with something.
Well, I think busing people in from out of state is one measure.
Tea Party never does that. Well, I thought our friend from Chicago went to Madison.
I didn't say that.
I went on my own dime. I wasn't bused in by a union boss.
I didn't say that. What I'm just saying is that people who were sitting home in Wisconsin watching this on television, many of whom voted for Mr. Walker, many of whom who did not, they're sitting at home. They're the ones we want to know how they really feel about it.
And I would say one other thing. I think if the turnout in a presidential year of 2012 is anything like the turnout in 2008, I think Democrats like that scenario more than they did in the depressed turnout of 2010.
Okay. So no one at this table likes the idea. You do like the idea.
I don't think Scott
Walker for president. You want Scott Walker to run for president?
I shouldn't,
because he'd be a great rallying point for the Democrats.
I think it's like, Sarah Palin, if you're 2 years into your first 4-year term as governor, that's too early.
She never lit a spark like this.
That's true. You know what? Maybe it's not
when you got you know what you know it, it's like you know it's you know you give a speech to the Democratic convention. You light the fire.
Yeah.
All right? It's lightning in the bottle,
right,
and it's your moment, and you seize it. And by golly, you pull off one of the great upsets in the history of the country.
That's right.
And you become president of the United States. My point is, why can that same dynamic not take place 4 years later with a governor of Wisconsin who decides to stand up, we're going to draw the line, we're going to have this discussion. The political left and the labor unions, they want the public to discuss this. His supporters want to, all right, let's rumble.
Let's
take it to the polls. Let's find out the people that are sitting home in their homes all over the United States watching this on TV, and they're going to find out whether they agree with Dan Johnson Weinberger or Chris Voronis on this issue.
And I'll tell you.
And they can vote either for Barack Obama or they can vote for Scott Walker to be the president of the United States.
He may be recalled before that. He may be. There.
If he isn't? Obviously, if he's recalled, then you've won, and my case means nothing.
That's why I think.
But if he is overwhelming, if the recall overwhelmingly fails, how do you measure that?
Well, that's a strength for him then, if that happens. No doubt. If the Republicans win all their recall elections, then that prairie fire is burning hot. But right now, I think you have to say, looking good for the Democrats.
Let's go to Greg in Champaign, Illinois. Everybody likes a little champagne on a Sunday night. Go ahead.
Hey, good glass of champagne would be nice about now, except I'm driving. A couple things. I'm middle class, and I've never belonged to a union in my life, and I never would. Secondly, I fortunately live in a right-to-work state, Tennessee, and our governor, Bill Haslam, is pushing a thing to our legislature that's going to pass regarding teachers, that he's going to extend the limits of tenure before he can get tenure from 3 to 5 years, And the best part is your tenure can be revoked if you become a crummy teacher. That is one of the weaknesses of the NEA. And my wife is a teacher, and she and a bunch of her other teachers absolutely support this because there are crap teachers out there that need to be fired. But they're covered by their union membership. And my wife and several of her other friends have just quit the TEA, which is the state version, and they're joining another group just to keep the legal representation up in case they get sued by parents and all that kind of stuff, which is the only reason she was a member of the union in the first place. Other than that, they did absolutely nothing for her. But I think that you're going to see a revolution on the teacher side of a lot of good teachers that don't want to teach anymore with crummy teachers that can't be fired because they're protected by a lousy union.
Well, look, I agree that work rules need to be modernized. I agree that bad teachers ought to be fired. But I think the core benefit of a labor union and collective bargaining is to raise wages. And the consequences of...
I negotiated for my own wages for every job that I have. I earn my promotions through my hard work and bringing a set of skills and assets to every employer I ever worked for. I also worked for two millionaires once upon a time, and they paid me exceedingly well. And I am really getting sick and tired of the left bashing the rich. If you don't like the rich people, please move to another country because they're the ones that create thousands upon thousands upon thousands of jobs by putting their capital at risk. And you know what's the point of let's back?
Wait a minute, hold on. You made two separate points.
That's all you know how to do. That's
you made two separate points. Your first point is that you've negotiated every single one of your salary benefits, and you know, good for you. Do you really think it's reasonable that somebody working at a low-skilled job is in a position to negotiate a wage that can support a family against the biggest corporations in the world?
Do you know what's the point of
yes or no, sir?
You obviously don't know anything about business. So
yeah, I run a business. I run a business, sir.
Let me tell you how it works, dude.
Why don't you answer yes or no?
You pay somebody what they're worth, and if you're not worth getting paid a decent wage, then you're not supposed to, then you need to do what it takes to become a better asset to that employer where you can earn more money.
So in other words,
what you said was no. Minimum wage was $1.50 an hour, and I said I am not going to stay at that wage.
So what you said was no, it's not reasonable for somebody to negotiate a family wage, and if people don't make enough money to support a family, well, too bad for them.
What are you doing having a family on a minimum wage? What an idiot is that?
Right. Well, hey,
all right, on that note of social advice, we're going to pause 1-800-723-8289. Back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. According to the Gallup poll, the public favor against Walker is 52-46. So we'll see whether that will stand, as I've discussed here, whether or not he might emerge as a presidential candidate. Some people think that's a good idea. Others do not. Let's go to Joe listening on the internet. Gurney in Illinois. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, Bruce, I've got to take exception with something you said about making the contract. You stick with it. You've got no choice, all that. Look, over the last 20 years, the public sector unions have funneled billions of dollars to the Democrats. In exchange, they got these promises that now amount to a $3 trillion unfunded debt that's stuck on the public. Look, it was a corrupt deal from the beginning. They should have known that what they were doing was simply bribing government officials, and that in the future, when the bill came due, it was perfectly possible there'd be somebody else in charge, the Republicans, and that they wouldn't be able to carry it out. You knew that going in. You knew you were bribing them. You don't have any right to complain about it, so just get off it.
Okay, well, I disagree with that. I mean, I understand your point. I just disagree with it because, first of all, I don't believe that necessarily everyone understood that. And second of all, I mean, you're planning your entire life based on one set of assumptions. And to me, if a commitment has been made by government, even if it's a bad commitment, it deserves to be kept.
An individual teacher or public sector employee feels that he did not know what was going on, that he's now surprised by all of this, and shame on him for not paying attention in the first place what his union leaders were doing all along.
No, I agree with that, and also, shame on those elected officials who began the process of not properly funding you know, the pensions when they became due. And that's
the Democrats.
That's the responsibility of those that were in charge from both parties. I think if you look historic, at least in the state of Illinois, I think you would find that there's been some bipartisanship in making that decision. So thanks very much. We disagree on that point, but we move on. Let's go to Elizabeth, listening to us in New Mexico, the land of enchantment. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Well, I'm just trying to respond to the last caller. I think maybe he had a point with what he said. This isn't the student council. This is the lives of all the people of the world. And I had called previously about, first of all, I'd like to say that I was in the 1964 earthquake in Alaska, and it is horrific. And the military, your first obligation is to help all people in Japan. And I've lived in Japan. I've been there. My heart goes out to them. I've also been a teacher, so I sympathize with the teachers.
So, ma'am, we're getting a very bad call, so we're going to move on. Again, it's the quality of the call, not the content of the call. Let us go to Boston, Massachusetts, where Scott is listening to us. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I want to say a few things without being interrupted by the liberal. I come from the People's Republic of Massachusetts, where they basically bankrupted everything in sight. And what I want to say is basic economics are at play here, the law of supply and demand. If there's too much labor, the rate of labor or the wage should go down. I own a payroll company. I've watched so many private sector companies go down in employee counts because there isn't any demand, so they can't hire people. And that's what drives wages and labor down. The other thing I want to say is this. Your liberal pal there, he seems to like to gimme, gimme, gimme. Whatever happened to ask not what your country can do for you, but what can you do for your country? Seems like the Democrats are the exact opposite of this now, and the same with unions.
Can I respond?
I put a muzzle on him. He now wants to respond to you.
Can I respond?
Go ahead.
The liberal
Dan.
Pal would say, well, Danny. I would ask my Republican friends that make more than $250,000 and spend all
not
of their
rich,
political.
By the way.
Wait a minute. I thought I wasn't supposed to be interrupted. I thought all the people that made more than $250,000 that spent all of their political capital on saying, no matter what, don't raise taxes by 3% on us. We millionaires, we hedge fund billionaires, don't raise taxes on us. What happened to ask not what I can do for my country? Doesn't that apply to them too, my Boston new conservative friend?
That had nothing to do with that at all.
Why not?
Okay. The bottom line is that people in this country used to have a right to have a profit, and that's their business. It's their business. The government, the private sector versus the government sector are two different entities. And, you know, the employer should set the rules as opposed to the employees setting the rules. The tail shouldn't be wagging the dog.
So basically,
and, you know, competence is what we're talking about here.
So do you think we should abolish laws against child labor?
Look,
I'm asking. Oh, no, it's not relevant. It's all the question of degree, right? We agree right
You're
now.
You're talking about minors versus adults.
Fine. You think people should be able to raise a family on their wage? Or you think they should be working in poverty?
I don't believe in the ends is in the Marxist model.
All right,
you get paid for competence, and the marketplace sets the wage.
So you're for working poverty. Yeah. Great. I can't wait for the debate on that one, because I think most people aren't going to be for perpetual working poverty.
I'm not for that. I pay people much more. I just don't hire people if they can't do a job that's worth more money.
You're against laws that are going to create a middle class. That means you're for working poverty. That's the reality.
We have a middle class, and it's being destroyed.
Based on what is that the reality? Give me the credible evidence. Give me the fact.
Look at how wages have been falling over the last 30 years. Unions increase wages. You're against raising wages because you're against empowering unions. So you're for continuing working poverty.
On that note, we are out of time. Our friend from Boston, he has moved back into his corner. And my buddy, my pal, the liberal here, Dan Johnson-Weinberger, will crawl back into his box until he returns next. Chris Verona's been with us. Steve Sedgwick, thanks very much. From the Tea Party in Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Jason Scheer for their production of this program tonight and for the last several months. Jason's going to move on to some bigger and better things, but hopefully will return to us someday. Until next week at the same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.